I was talking about the universe and how about cosmologists, how they think about these great theories about the universe. And are there infinite number of universes? Is there a multiverse? So if there's an infinite number of universes, then what you will have, this is what the cosmologists theorize. I believe this is what they theorize, that somewhere else in some other universe, if there's an infinite number of universes, mathematically they can say, they can prove it, or they can make an equation, or just make a, they can posit that there's somebody in another universe, and he looks just, he or she looks just like you. She is doing the exact same thing that you're doing, and she's a duplicate of you. And there's all kinds of other theories. So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, okay, how come galaxies move apart? Why is the space in between the galaxies expanding so much? And I guess cosmologists, they're the ones that make up the theories. They probably say, oh, it's dark energy or dark matter. So we're going to read this, and this is going to give us another piece of the puzzle. It's still such a big puzzle, I can't decipher it. But here we go. New clues about how ancient galaxies lit up the universe. This is on www.nasa.gov, dated May 8th, 2019. So here it goes. NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope has revealed that some of the universe's earliest galaxies were brighter than expected. The excess light is a byproduct of the galaxies releasing incredibly high amounts of ionizing radiation. So I'm wondering, why would they do that? Why would they release a lot of ionizing radiation? Got to think about that. The finding offers clues to the cause of the epoch of reionization, a major cosmic event that transformed the universe from being mostly opaque to the brilliant starscape seen today. In a new study, researchers report on observations of some of the first galaxies to form in the universe less than 1 billion years after the Big Bang, or a little more than 13 billion years ago. The data show that in a few specific wavelengths of infrared light, the galaxies are considerably brighter than scientists anticipated. The study is the first to confirm this phenomena for a large sampling of galaxies from this period, showing that these were not special cases of excessive brightness, but that even average galaxies present at that time were much brighter in these wavelengths than galaxies we see today. No one knows for sure when the first stars in the universe burst to life. So I'm going to pause for a second here. They show that a billion years after the Big Bang, the data show that a few specific wavelengths of infrared light, for a few specific wavelengths of infrared light, the galaxies are considerably brighter than scientists anticipated. So this was called a period of, what was it called? The epoch of reionization. Reionization, a major cosmic event that transferred the universe from being mostly opaque to brilliant starscape we see today. No one knows for sure when the first stars in the universe burst to life, but evidence suggests that between about 100 million and 200 million years after the Big Bang, the universe was filled mostly with neutral hydrogen gas that had perhaps just begun to coalesce in the stars, which then began to form the first galaxies. So I guess 100 million to 200 million years after the Big Bang, there was just mostly neutral hydrogen gas. And it seems it just had started to clump or coalesce into stars by about, so it had to be cool. By about 1 billion years after the Big Bang, the universe had become a sparkling firmament. Something else had changed too. Electrons of the omnipresent neutral hydrogen gas had been stripped away in a process known as ionization. The epoch of reionization, the changeover from a universe full of neutral hydrogen to one filled with ionized hydrogen, is well documented. Okay, so something had to ionize these atoms. So I guess when an electron is in its orbiting its hydrogen atom, and hydrogen atom is just a proton, basically. So electron is orbiting a proton, and it's behaving like an atom, I guess. And then some light hit that electron, energized it enough so it could jump away and ionize. So the hydrogen was ionized, and all we had was protons. So that supposedly is this epoch of reionization. Before this universe, wide transformation, long wavelength forms of light, such as radio waves and visible light, traverse the universe more or less unencumbered. Let's see, so I'll stop here. Before this, universe-wide transformation, long wavelength forms of light, such as radio waves and visible light, traverse the universe. So my question that would pop in my head now is, okay, you had the Big Bang, so all of a sudden, out of nothing, it seems, boom, you have a Big Bang. You have, I don't know if it's an explosion, but what it is, it's boom, something happens. So then all of a sudden you have matter, and then you have light. So where did this matter and light come from? The nothingness of this, I don't know what to call it. Is it a singularity? That's what they call it, I think, in a black hole. But it supposedly had infinite density. So all of a sudden, bang, then matter and light comes out. So at this time, there were shorter wavelengths of light, ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma rays, were stopped short by neutral hydrogen atoms. But the long waves, such as radio, visible, and what else, transferred the universe more or less unencumbered. So long wavelengths of light were just traveling around. They were not being absorbed. So these were radio waves and visible light. But shorter wavelengths of light, such as ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma ray, were stopped short by neutral hydrogen atoms. So these collisions, which stripped the neutral hydrogen atoms of their electrons, ionizing them. So all of a sudden, you'd have a bunch of protons and electrons. But what could have possibly produced enough ionizing radiation to affect all the hydrogen universe? Was it individual stars, giant galaxies? If either were the culprit, these early cosmic colonizers would have been different than most modern stars and galaxies, which typically don't release high amounts of ionizing radiation. So I guess the question they're asking is, where did this ionizing radiation come from? And again, I questioned it earlier. I said, out of this singularity, this infinite point, whatever it was, that the Big Bang came from, all of a sudden you had hydrogen atoms spouting out of that. Then you had light. So there was long wavelength and short wavelength. So what was it that, what could have possibly produced the ionization, ionizing radiation to affect the hydrogen in the universe? So the article here says, was it individual stars or giant galaxies? But then again, there's another explanation. Perhaps something else entirely caused the events, such as quasars, galaxies with incredibly bright center powered by huge amounts of material orbiting supermassive black holes. Okay, so here we have quasars, another explanation, but I thought we're like in the infancy of the universe. We're 100 million or 200 million years after the Big Bang, and all of a sudden they're saying there's stars and there's galaxies and there's quasars and also black holes in the universe. So they're saying, well, the light could have come from these things. But I thought the universe was so infant, was so young, it was just a little baby. How could it already have quasars and all these big galaxies and black holes? So we're going to listen to somebody called Stéphane de Barros, the lead author of the study and a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. And quote, It's one of the biggest open questions in observational cosmology. We know what happened, but what caused it? These new findings could be a big clue. Now there's a subtitle, Looking for Light. So all of a sudden, they're getting to the explanation. They're saying, well, it could have been this, it could have been that. But I thought, for example, if it was this or that, which means if it was a black hole or a quasar, well, it would not have had time to form because this was in the infancy of the universe. So let's look at what they say here to clear it up. Okay, now there's a subtitle. It says, Looking for Light. To peer back in time to the era just before the epoch of reionization ended, Spitzer stared at two regions of the sky for more than 200 hours each. Somebody's eating pizza outside, and it looks good. So Spitzer's looking at two areas of the sky for more than 200 hours each, allowing the space telescope to collect light that had traveled for more than 13 billion years to reach us. As some of the longest science observations ever carried out by Spitzer, they were part of an observing campaign called GREATS. So big G, big R, big E, big A, big T, big S, short for Goods, Reionization, Era, Wide Area, Treasury from Spitzer. Goods, itself an acronym, Great Observatory Origins Deep Space Survey, is another campaign that performed the first observations of some GREATS targets. The study, published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, also used archival data from NASA's Hubble Space Telescope. Using these ultra-deep observations by Spitzer, the team of astronomers observed 135 distant galaxies and found that they were all particularly bright in two specific wavelengths of infrared light produced by ionizing radiation interacting with hydrogen and oxygen gases within the galaxies. So again, if this was a long way away, did oxygen ever exist? This was supposed to be 100 to 200 million years after the Big Bang. And they're saying we have this radiation that is maybe from a black hole, maybe from a quasar, and it's interacting with oxygen and hydrogen. But I didn't even think oxygen existed at that time. So I'll read on and see what they say. This implies that these galaxies were dominated by young massive stars composed mostly of hydrogen and helium. They contain very small amounts of heavy elements like nitrogen, carbon, and oxygen compared to stars found in average modern galaxies. These stars were not the first stars to form in the universe. Those would have been composed of hydrogen and helium only, but were still members of a very early generation of stars. The epoch of reionization wasn't an instantaneous event, so while the new results are not enough to close the book on this cosmic event, they do provide new details about how the universe evolved at this time and how the transition played out. Okay, so now we're going to go to a break. And when I come back, I think I'll talk more astronomy. So now we're talking about, what are we talking about? I'll get the title rather than mess it up. New clues about how ancient galaxies lit up the universe. So to me, there's some kind of hard to understand because this is the ancient galaxies, this is the ancient universe, and they're saying, okay, this is 100 million to 200 million years after the Big Bang, but then they're saying quasars and black holes existed. Okay, so when I come back, we'll talk more astronomy. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at CITR. So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Salam. Roozetun bekhair. My name is Sahand, the president of UBC Persian Club.
And this is Yasaman, the VP admin.
UBC Persian Club is a non-profit student organization with the goal of empowering the Iranian community at UBC by acting as a social hub for Iranian students, bringing together diverse members of the community who have a common interest in Iranian culture, and nurturing and representing the Iranian community in Vancouver.
We have monthly member-exclusive events, Pilon, we screen documentary movies and short films by Iranian directors with English subtitles. Music gatherings, a series of casual music gatherings at which students can play different types of instruments, and sports events and game nights.
Our regular events are member exclusive and you will receive 25% discount on our annual events. You can visit us at ubcpc.com or email us through info@ubcpc.com.
Or you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year but will next year, and to our community as a whole. CITR and Discorder just want to say...
This is a journey into sound. Gotta have house
music. Gotta have house. Hi, this is DJ Wah inviting you to join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. here on 101.9 CITR for Techno Progressivo. You in my heart now,
my life. This is the house that funk built. This is the house that funk built.
Techno Progressivo is the only radio show in Vancouver where you'll hear the best mix of new tech house, techno, and progressive house.
A body bang. A...
So join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. for Techno Progressivo.
House music. House music.
Back. You're at UBC and you're listening to AstroTalk with Marco and Adina Howard on CITR 101.9. Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk, and we're talking about galaxies in the beginning of the universe. Ancient galaxies, more like it, and how they lit up the universe. So this is an article on www.nasa.gov, and again, the title is New Clues About How Ancient Galaxies Lit Up the Universe, May 8th, 2019. Okay, so I'm going to go to a quote now that... is by Michael Werner, Spitzer's project scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and quote, we did not expect that Spitzer, with a mirror no larger than a hula hoop, would be capable of seeing galaxies so close to the dawn of time. But nature is full of surprises, and the unexpected brightness of these early galaxies, together with Spitzer's superb performance, puts them within range of our small but powerful observatory, end quote. Okay, I wish I had a telescope with a mirror no larger than a hula hoop. My mirror is so small, and one of them is cracked, so I can't see a lot, and I'm in the city anyway. Okay, so they're seeing galaxies so close to the dawn of time. So NASA's James Webb Telescope set to launch in 2021. I thought it was going to be earlier than that, but anyway, okay. NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, set to launch in 2021, will study the universe in many of the same wavelengths observed by Spitzer. I just want to get a pause here. I love talking about anniversaries, and there's a 60th anniversary coming up. I'll talk about it when we get back. Okay, so NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, launching in 2021, will study the universe in many of the same wavelengths observed by Spitzer. But where Spitzer's primary mirror is only 85 centimeters, or 33.4 inches in diameter, Webb's is 6.5 meters, or 21 feet, about 7.5 times larger. Wow. Enabling Webb to study these galaxies in far greater detail. Okay, so let's get this straight. This Spitzer is going to be about, 250 or 60 inches, and the other one is only 33 inches. So Spitzer is 33 inches, James Webb is 250 or 60, so 7.5 times larger, enabling Webb to study these galaxies in far greater detail. So when I see something like that, a fine piece of machine, like when you see a beautiful telescope and the beautiful mirror and all, oh, it just gives me such a great feeling. So imagine, I could just imagine what it'd be like to see this 21 meters across, 250 or 60 inches in diameter, the telescope. It would be a marvel. In fact, Webb will be, In fact, Webb will try to detect light from the first stars and galaxies in the universe. The new study shows that due to their brightness in those infrared wavelengths, the galaxies observed by Spitzer will be easier for Webb to study than previously thought. So says Pascal Oish, an assistant professor at the University of Geneva and a co-author of the study, and quote, "These results by Spitzer are certainly another step in solving the mystery of cosmic reionization." I'll talk about that later, okay? "We now know that the physical conditions in these early galaxies were very different than in typical galaxies today. It will be the job of the James Webb Space Telescope to work out the detailed reasons why," end quote. So that's the end of the article. So now they're talking about, they said, "The new study shows that due to their brightness in those infrared wavelengths, the galaxies observed by Spitzer will be easier for Webb to study than previously thought." Okay, so previously thought, that's a good quote. I want to use that. A lot of these amazing scientists, like Professor Unruh here and other brilliant people, they take these, their mind works in a certain way. I don't know. I can't figure it out, but they come up with these theories. And an example I talked about last week was the Voyager spacecraft. So when it hits interstellar space, the scientists already have their models of what they think interstellar space will be like. And when their Voyager spacecraft hits interstellar space, all their theories and models are confirmed, which is quite amazing because we've never been to interstellar space before. We can't imagine, you know, you can't get a telescope to point out interstellar space and study it. So a lot of these things, and a lot of this thing about these galaxies, it happened a long time ago, billions of years ago. We weren't there. We didn't have any telescopes. Now scientists are looking back into time with Spitzer and stuff. But very often what happens is when the data comes in, it confirms their theories. So how these scientists can make these brilliant theories, and sometimes it says than previously thought. So sometimes their theories need tweaking or refining, But so often it's like they study something that has happened like eons ago. We can't have seen it before. They make their theories, and then the theories, they're correct. So to me, that's amazing how they can make these theories about places we've never been, we've never seen, way back in time, and their theories are correct. But of course, there's more studying to be done, and that's where they're doing it. So they're trying to solve this puzzle of cosmic epoch of reionization. But they have their theories, and they'll learn more and more. But to me, it just boggles my mind that they can come up with these amazing theories in the first place, and they can understand the process, and that at the end, a lot of their theories are confirmed, and say, yes, I was right. So just like his name escapes me now, Kip Thorne, when he was designing the LIGO Observatory years before, there was a certain tolerance that he looked for and in the instruments, and it was confirmed. So how can a guy 20 years before the fact, when nobody has studied this thing, and Einstein made the theory of there was going to be gravitational waves. So they say, okay, I'm going to make the specs like this because this is what I think we'll be able to see. And when they finally find it, when they find this gravitational event, bang, he was correct. And to me, that just boggles my mind because I can't imagine how these people can be so brilliant and work with theories in a topic that is really difficult to understand and talk about a place that we've never been to. And they're correct. So it's amazing. So we have to applaud these people for their brilliance, for their insights, and for making my life, my dull life, much more interesting. Thank you, all you scientists. Keep doing your wonderful science. So they're studying it more, and just like a scientist that I was reading or I was listening to the TV show the other day, a student started asking questions, and then when the question was answered, he went on to the next question. And then when he answered, he said, well, why did this happen? And then when he answered that, he says, well, why did that happen? And then the scientist finally says, well, it's going to be up to you to discover that final answer because we don't know everything. And this is the process where we just keep digging. And the answers are partially out there, but there's these brilliant theorists that guide us there. So anyway, blah, blah, blah. I just went on a soliloquy. So I think we do have to give proper thanks to the brilliant minds that solved not only cosmic questions, but like, for example, medicine, chemistry, all this biology, mathematics that makes our lives better. So I'm going to go to an anniversary now. Why not? Why not go to an anniversary? It's NASA Goddard Space Flight Center celebrate 60 years. So I believe Goddard was a rocket scientist that made many advances in the field of rocket science. And what I do recall when I was talking about when they were going to the moon, it's not just the case of, okay, put the gas in this big, big cylinder and then burn it, and then the thrust, the gas will come flying out of one end and it'll push the spacecraft up. Well, there's certain things you have to take into account, and what if this thing all of a sudden explodes, which it could do. So there's all these things they have to figure out in order to make rockets work. So I believe Goddard was one of the fathers of rocket scientists, and we're going to celebrate NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center celebrates 60 years. On May 1st, so this is on NASA.gov, released April 29, 2019, and again, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center celebrates 60 years. On May 1st, 1959, the Beltsville Space Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, was renamed NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in honor of Robert H. Goddard. Yeah, Robert H. Goddard, who widely considered the father of modern rocketry. And that's what I thought. So Goddard is the father. Robert H. Goddard was a brilliant man, the father of modern rocketry. Thus began a 60-year boom in science and technological innovation. The center has led or contributed to many of the agency's accomplishments, ranging from missions to the moon, to detecting the first light in the universe, and arriving at an asteroid to collect arriving at an asteroid in space to collect a sample. Goddard now boasts the largest concentration of scientists and engineers dedicated to the study of Earth and space, and has successfully sent more than 300 satellites into orbit, secured more than 800 patents, produced more than 50,000 science and technological publications, and contributed to several significant awards, including the Nobel Prize in Physics. So I recall in the 80s, I used to go to Los Angeles a lot in the mid-80s. And at that time, there's, I guess, 70s and the 80s and the 60s, there was that big Cold War with Russia. So a lot of defense firms were in the Los Angeles area. So it wasn't Silicon Valley, but it was the city of Los Angeles, which had the highest concentration of scientists and engineers in the world. So there's lots of these, like Houston Space Center, Florida's Kennedy Space Center. They have such a great, and of course, my favorite place on Earth, or one of my favorite places. Hi, Trina. This is got to be the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. So imagine how many brilliant scientists are in there. All that brain power, amazing, isn't it? So I'm going to read a little picture here. It says, Goddard Space Flight Center was established on May 1st, 1959, as NASA's first space flight center in celebration of its 60th year. We look back at the innovations and scientific impacts the women and men of Goddard have made throughout its history. So there's a video here, and it's quite interesting, I think. And it's the article is called NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center Celebrates 60 Years, and it is dated April 29, 2019. And there's a little thing which I clicked, and it talks about Dr. Robert H. Goddard, American rocketry pioneer. It is difficult to say what is impossible, for the dreams of yesterday are the hopes of today and the reality of tomorrow. This is what Dr. Robert Hutchins Goddard said. This is a quote. So Dr. Robert Hutchins Goddard, 1882 to 1945, is considered the father of modern rocket propulsion. A physicist of great insight, Goddard also had a unique genius for invention. It is in memory of this brilliant scientist that NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, was established on May 1, 1959. By 1926, Goddard had constructed and successfully tested the first rocket using liquid fuel. Indeed, the flight of Goddard's rocket on March 16, 1926, at Auburn, Massachusetts, was as significant to history as that of the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. I guess we don't think about that. Primitive in their day as the achievement of the Wrights, Goddard's rockets made little impression on government officials. Only through modest subsidies from the Smithsonian Institute and the Daniel Guggenheim Foundation, as well as the leaves of absence granted him by the Worcester Polytechnic Institute of the Clark University, was Goddard able to sustain his lifetime of devoted research and testing. Goddard first attained public notice in 1907 in a cloud of smoke from a powder rocket fired in the basement of the Worcester Polytechnic Institute Physics Building. School officials took an immediate interest in the work of student Goddard. He was a student then. Wow. The school's administration, to their credit, did not expel him. He thus began his lifetime of dedicated work. In 1914, Goddard received two U.S. patents, one was for a rocket using liquid fuel, the other was for a two- or three-stage rocket using solid fuel. So there we go. Rockets were pioneered by Goddard, and it shows his major accomplishments here. Shot a scientific payload in a rocket flight in 1929. developed and fired a liquid-fueled rocket in 1926, proved that a rocket will work in a vacuum, that it needs no air to push again. Now, that's interesting, because that's what I've always thought about. Because usually we think of Newton's second law. We have a fuel thrusted out, okay? So the according to Newton's second law, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So the fuel thrusts out, hits the air, pushes the air pushes back, and it pushes the rocket forward. So that's what he proved, that you don't need, you could do it in a vacuum and the rocket would still work. Okay, so we're talking about rockets, we're talking about Goddard, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center celebrates 60 years. So this article says his innovations, Goddard's innovations, were just as important to us as a race as, let's say, the Wright brothers' flight. And of course, jet airplanes go by rocket propulsion. They shoot jets of burning gas out of their back and they get pushed forward. Okay, so this was a really good article. I liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And when we come back, we are going to talk more about astronomy. So when we come back, we will talk, not Goddard, something else. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Now repeat after me. Bugger off. Bugger off. Sod. Sod. Bloody. Bloody. Now put them all together. Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Okay, you're in.
Let's smash things up.
Every Saturday from noon to 1 p.m., listen to Generation Annihilation on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC Radio in Vancouver.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
Could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Send me wine up the ting till it pile up. Big bumper gal, just a wine and a while up. They must spoil me a stock till it pile up. My money no, so it my money
no. Like you mean it. Dance like you on fire and you want me to know. You move like you mean it, shawty. See the look on your face. You either wanna fight or wanna make love, maybe both. They got me looking at you, looking at you, watching the way you wind it and pop it. One more time, go wind and pop it. Yeah, yeah. Bumper that drink got me feeling alright. Pretty little thing, I could watch it all night. Pull up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Pull up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. So when I jump behind it, push back on me. So baby, push back when I jump behind it. Baby, let me know you like it. Tonight, let's give them something to see. Everybody's singing.
You're listening to Mayo on CITR 101.9 on Marco's Astrotalk. Push back.
So don't want you.
amazing. Come on, baby, chase it. Back to the floor, give us space. And
looking at me, watching the way I wanted him popping. One more time, I wanted him.
Hello, welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Mayo on CITR 101.9 and Cephalon Dawn. Okay, so we're coming back. Now we're going to talk to a computer engineer. So computer engineer Harvey Walden has worked at Goddard for 56 years and had seen advancements unimaginable 60 years ago. Here is computer engineer Harvey Walden, and quote, "I witnessed many changes at Goddard over the last 56 years of Goddard's 60-year history. Nothing describes him better than Dr. Robert H. Goddard's own oft-quoted maxim, which is, it is difficult to say what is impossible, for the dream of yesterday is the hope of today and the reality of tomorrow." End quote. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center proves the truth of that statement better than almost any place on Earth. So let's talk about Dr. Goddard. So here he was, 1907, a student. There's no textbooks on this stuff. It's not like his professor tells him, okay, Robert, here's the theory of rockets. Go and build a little rocket yourself. No, he went and did it himself. So a lot of this stuff that he came up with, it's not in textbooks. Like when Einstein did his theory of relativity, it wasn't in a textbook. And when Chandrasekhar first figured out that stars could go on and collapse and there could be a neutron star formed, no one had a textbook there for him. Here, study this textbook. If someone gives me a textbook now and I study it, I might be able to study it. I might not be able to. It's tough stuff. But these people came up with these advancements, with these innovations, with these inventions. There was no textbook. There was nothing done. You know, there's obviously pathfinders. People have done the work before them. But here he was when he was in first year university. He made a rocket. Instead of the school expelling him, they say, go ahead. Go for it. Do some more research on it. Okay, so he developed gyro control apparatus for rocket flight, used vanes in the rocket motor blast for guidance, shot a scientific payload in a rocket flight, received U.S. patent for multi-stage rockets, developed pumps suitable for rocket fuels, launched a rocket with a motor pivoted on gimbals under the influence of a gyro mechanism, 1937. Now, how could this person have done this and his... A lot of the stuff he did on his first fuel, liquid fuel rocket, was on March 16th, 1960. No, it says 1961. I don't even know if he was alive then. No, he died. But let's try to get this, because he launched something from Aunt Elfie's farm. So I got to read it. No, Aunt Effie's farm. Esther Goddard was on hand for the formal Okay, here. Esther Goddard was on hand for the formal dedication of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center on March 16, 1961. Okay, here it is. 35 years to the day after the professor launched the first liquid fuel rocket from his Aunt Effie's farm. So he did it all by himself. He launched something from his Aunt Effie's farm. So this was, I think it was a good story. It shows us our history on science and how they honor pioneers like Dr. Robert R.H. Goddard and the Goddards. So he was the father of modern rocketry. Very interesting. I doubt I could even read his books and understand it today. But here he was on his Aunt Effie's farm doing all these experiments and all of a sudden launching a rocket when no one had done it before. So it's quite incredible. So we have to give our props to Dr. Robert Goddard. Okay, so let's go to another. Hubble's. I read that before. Oh, here's another historical thing. Let's talk about Asian American. So this is an article dated May 8th, 2019. For all you Japanese listeners, someone who might be listening to me from Japan or here, Ellison Onizuka, the first Asian American in space. Ellison Onizuka was the first Asian American to fly in space. He was a member of NASA's astronaut class of 1978, also known as the 35 New Guys, the first astronaut class nearly a decade, and also the first to include women, Hispanics, Asians, and African Americans. Before becoming an astronaut, Colonel Onizuka had a distinguished career with the United States Air Force when he served as a flight test engineer and as a test pilot. At the Sacramento Air Logistics Center at McClellan Air Force Base, he worked in a test flight program. He worked in test flight programs and system security engineering for a variety of aircraft, including the F-84, F-100, F-105, F-111, or F-111, and A-1. Onizuka also attended the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, so I guess his relatives were very proud of the man. While at the school, he registered more than 1,700 flight hours. Imagine what it'd be like to fly something like a F-11 or F-100 or F-84, these fast planes that zoom. Okay, after joining NASA, maybe After joining NASA and completing astronaut training, Onizuka's first space mission was aboard Space Shuttle Discovery on mission STS-51-C in 1985. On January 28, 1986, Onizuka lost his life when Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after launch. That's too bad. It was tragic when that space shuttle exploded. So here we are. We are giving the proper recognition to Ellison Onizuka, the first Asian American in space. And it's too bad he lost his life in the space shuttle. He was on Space Shuttle Discovery. Onizuka's first space mission was aboard Space Shuttle Discovery on mission STS-51-C in 1985. So we give our regards to Ellison Onizuka and his family, the first Asian American in space. Okay, so today we talked about Hubble astronauts assemble wide. No, we talked about that last time. Okay, so thank you for listening. This has been another edition of AstroTalk. And hopefully I keep saying this. I've been a bit busy lately, and I really want to get some more interviews, because when you get to the interviews for myself, at least that's the most fascinating thing, because all of a sudden you're hearing it from the word of an expert, someone who's at the cutting edge of the field. Like when I talked to Miss Trina Ray, they are experts. They're dedicated, brilliant scientists. They've been at it for a lot of years. So thank you for listening. This has been another edition of AstroTalk. And when I come back next week, maybe I might have some news for you about a guest I might have. Hopefully I can get my rear end up and contact somebody. So thank you for listening. This was Marco. You were listening today to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.